This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tropical storm warnings already been issued for much of eastern Massachusetts as we await the arrival of Tropical Storm Elsa. And if you feel like we haven't dried out yet from all the rain over the weekend, you are not alone. In fact, Boston just witnessed the wettest first week of July in over 100 years by a lot. After a scorching June, it seems like this volatility has got to leave a mark. WBUR meteorologist David Epstein joins us to talk about that and to tell us what to expect as this latest storm arrives. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Nice to be here.
Great to have you, Dave. And let's start with the incoming storm. Walk us through, if you could, kind of the timeline. When do you expect things to pick up? Is it going to be rain and wind tonight?
Yeah, so right now the storm centered over North Carolina, so it's still pretty far away, and there could be some showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, especially west of 495. It's not really related to the storm at all. As a matter of fact, we have kind of cool marine air over us right now. If you've been outside today, it's rather comfortable, but if you were down in New York City, it's in the mid-80s and very humid and similar to what we experienced yesterday. So that dividing line is producing some showers and storms the rest of the afternoon into the evening hours. It's really tomorrow morning in the wee hours of the morning, and I'm talking, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, that a slug of rain is going to move up with Elsa. It's moving really fast, so I think between roughly that 3 o'clock in the morning and probably about noontime is when we will see the heaviest rain. It'll be ending a little earlier southwestern New England, a little later as you get on towards the coast of Maine, and that's when we'll see anywhere from 1 to 3, perhaps a few places getting over 3 inches of rain in a very short period of time.
How about wind and overall impactfulness of this storm? Are we looking at flooding, power outages?
Yeah, so I don't think it's really that big of a deal, to be honest. I mean, we've had a lot of rain this month, so you know, your basement, if you're susceptible to flooding during heavy rain events where you get an inch of rain in an hour, then you might want to check the sump pump or move things down in your basement that typically might get into a wet area. I think in terms of wind, the strongest wind's going to be roughly from that sunrise time up until maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and mostly southeastern Massachusetts. So there, winds could gust up to 60 miles an hour in a few places for a few hours tomorrow. And because the leaves are still on the trees, of course, this time of the year, the leaves act like little sails and can capture the wind a little more. So we could see a higher threshold for power outages or a higher amount of power outages than we would typically see with the same wind speed in the dead of winter because you don't have the leaves on the trees.
Okay, and this is a tropical storm, not a hurricane. Can you kind of remind us of the difference in how we should think about something called a tropical storm?
Yeah, so think of a tropical storm, in this case, as a nor'easter, right? It just doesn't have snow, it's not winter, and it's just basically a moderate nor'easter moving through the area. Winds between 39 miles an hour and 74 miles an hour is the tropical storm category. We won't get to that upper limit at all. And because it's going to hug the coastline, the winds that are strongest will be southeastern Massachusetts. So storms kind of have two sides to them, a windy side and a wet side. Everything to the right of the center of the storm is windy. Everything to the left of the center of the storm is wet. So Boston, 495 belt, 128 belt, Route 2, all on the wet side of the storm. So it's really heavy rain, a little travel difficulty tomorrow, some big puddles on the roads, perhaps some street flooding. And then on the southeastern side, some scattered power outages for sure. There'll be some trees down, not nearly as much rain over the Cape and the islands.
All right. And let's talk about rain and rain and rain, because when I read that this was the wettest first week of July in over 100 years, I mean, 100 years is a really big deal. Are we in something quite unusual here?
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely unusual. We started the spring really dry. I mean, as a gardener, I was sort of lamenting a little bit, uh-oh, are we going to go into a drought this summer? And, you know, it was April and May were kind of dry, but it was also beautiful. If you wanted to get outside, it was wonderful weather. And then all of a sudden June hit and we had the heat and we had plenty of rain in June. And we've certainly had more than enough rain here in July. So now all of a sudden we're actually above average for the year. There was only a drought for a couple of weeks. We've never been in a big drought around here this year anyway. There's still a little bit of drought left on the Cape. But for the most part, we have adequate rainfall. And it's just one of those years, at least so far, where we're on the wetter side of average. This summer is pretty amazing, though, to have this much rain. It's very green out there. No one's lawns are burning out for sure. And I'm actually worried about fungus and things like that in my vegetable garden, kind of going the other way. Too much rain, too much of a good thing at this point.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, even just the volatility, crazy hot in June, crazy wet in July, does that affect our plants?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's not going to affect, for the most part, it's not going to affect perennials and trees and shrubs in a way that's, you know, it might affect them a little bit this year. Things may not look good, but it really does affect the vegetables. My tomatoes are starting to get early blight, lower leaves. So I'm beginning to treat with some organic stuff to kind of get rid of that. And the longer you have this type of weather, you'll start to see some rotting occurring on vegetables, especially. And then if it were to last, we'd start to see some problems on some of the other fruit crops and things like that. Things that are kind of annual crops can be really susceptible to big fluctuations. A lot of heat, cool weather, really wet, not good for plants.
And Dave, in a sentence, when will it get nice again?
It'll be pretty nice on Saturday, although there's still a few showers. Sunday is my pick of the weekend, up near 80, plenty of sunshine. Get out and enjoy the great weather.
All right, go Saturday. That's David Epstein, WBUR meteorologist. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Turning now to politics, all this summer we will be inviting the major candidates officially running for governor here in Massachusetts to make their cases to you. And we'll begin with the latest entrant into the race, former state representative Jeff Diehl, running in the Republican primary. Diehl unsuccessfully ran against Senator Elizabeth Warren in 2018, co-chaired the 2016 campaign here in Massachusetts for Donald Trump. Representative Jeff Diehl, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, Tiziana, thank you so much.
It's good to have you. So you ran for offices for the Senate in 2018. Now it's 2021. You've declared for governor. What makes you better than anyone else now to be the governor of the Commonwealth and to run the state?
Well, I don't want to put it as better than anyone else, just different priorities. And I think some experience that may lend itself better to the position. Let's put it that way. I've served in the legislature for 8 years. I have a private sector experience. My wife and I own a small business. I work for another company as well. And look, we're like everybody else too. We've got two daughters, one in college, one in high school, just trying to make ends meet. I was furloughed during the pandemic. And so, you know, we certainly understand what's going on with people in Massachusetts. In 2018, I had the chance to travel around the state and meet a ton of people when I won the Republican primary to run against Elizabeth Warren for the Senate and learn really about what the regional issues were that I'd like to focus on. In fact, I was hoping at the time that the Senate seat would be more focused on what was important for Massachusetts. And now running for governor of Massachusetts, I think I had that real chance to talk about the issues that face our state, whether it's regionally or, you know, obviously in Boston, housing affordability. I think that, you know, my campaign right now is set up to be focused on Massachusetts, and I think that's really what's going to be a key factor in November of 2022.
So you've emphasized there a couple of times the Massachusetts focus. You have had a national tie. In 2018, you got support from then Vice President Mike Pence. You co-chaired the Trump campaign in 2016. It does appear that as you've begun this race, you are distancing yourself a bit from the president, but he has continued to press false narratives around the election in 2020 that it was stolen. Do you agree with him? And if he runs again in 2024, would you support him? Because that figures into your candidacy here in the Commonwealth.
No, I'm sure it does. And at this point, I don't think he's declared whether he's running or not. If he does decide to run, I'm still open to any other candidate that wants to make their case. I'm looking for the best person for the job at the time that they want to run. So, you know, in 2016, what he spoke about, drawing down troops in the Middle East, becoming energy independent, putting American economy first, those were things that I felt was important right here in Massachusetts to the district I was representing. And I think that that's why, he had strong support within the Republican Party here in Massachusetts. I know he didn't have support, you know, broadly in the state in general. But 2022 is a race, again, that I think is going to be more focused on what's important for our state, especially with a pandemic recovery. And that's really where I think the focus is going to be as we go forward.
Okay, and we will get there in a minute, but I do want to be clear here. Do you recognize Joe Biden as the legitimately elected president of the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you've ever seen anything of me stating any otherwise. I think that, you know, obviously certain states are questioning whether or not their process is good, but that's not, the national consensus is that he won the election. There's no dispute here.
Okay, so one more. Given that, is it dangerous to the country to have a head of your party who continues to assert that a legitimate Democratic election in our country was stolen?
Well, Tiziana, I'd like to ask you
where the former president
question about,
is.
Well, can I ask you the same question? Back in 2016, when President Trump won, the question was whether Russia had interfered and delivered him into the presidency. And I think there was serious concern that there was U.S. departments that had actually taken part in trying to make that look like that was the case. So, look, no, I don't think that it's healthy to go forward. I think the Republican Party is moving forward and looking at new candidates. But I don't think that either party has been very generous to either candidate when these elections have ended recently.
So I am going to assert that there is a categorical difference between in the comparisons that you're making. But then I'm going to move on because we have local things to talk about, too. You've talked about your race against Senator Warren in 2018. This is another statewide race. You didn't make the case successfully across the state last time. With this race, if you got the nomination, what's your path to election in a general election running as a Republican?
Well, actually, Tiziana, if you look at the results of 2018's election, I was the third highest vote total of all candidates that were running at the time, and that includes the Democratic slate for all the statewide offices. So, you know, I do think that I was able to reach quite a few voters well beyond my party's registration, as you know, which is fairly low in the state. So I think that, again, this is a chance to take what I learned in 2018 and that support that I had and continue to add to it. Specifically at a time when, you know, my record in the legislature has always been to try to make sure that households have the resources they need to, you know, obviously put kids through school, be able to retire, and, of course, have good jobs. In 2014, I led a repeal of the index gas tax that won statewide. In fact, at the time, candidate Baker supported that effort that I pushed forward. So, look, I think that I have definitely a track record of success, despite losing to the senator in 2018. I'm really looking forward to making my case.
Okay, you just mentioned candidate Baker, so let's talk about that, because, sort of pun intended, that is the elephant in the room here, Governor Baker, also a Republican. You have jumped into this race before he has announced his plans either way. Can we assume that that means you're saying that you do not believe he deserves a third term?
Well, look, I think the voters in the Republican primary are the ones who decide whether he deserves to have the opportunity to make the case for that third term. But I will say that regardless of whether he was going to run or not, it was my plan to make the entrance into the race. You know, I was really looking more at just my own ability to run another campaign. And, you know, obviously there's personal considerations with family and work. And I think that we came to the conclusion that, you know, it was worth doing this. You know, Governor Baker will certainly have to make the case as to, you know, why he deserves a third term. I understand that, you know, he gets support across the spectrum. But I think, again, this is going to be an interesting time because the pandemic certainly has pointed out areas of concern with management. And I think that that's a case I'll have to make, obviously, within the Republican primary.
You talked about management, and over the last week or, you know, few days in your interviews, you've been really clear in some areas of criticism of Charlie Baker: management around the pandemic, the vaccine rollout, the soldiers' home, the RMV, the cap and trade climate initiative. So since you've already spoken about those, let's put those aside. Where else do you think Charlie Baker has fallen short, or do you?
Well, I mean, the other thing, too, that we're currently could be doing is moving some of the there's federal funds that have just come in, about $5 billion, and then there's also state surplus of tax revenue that he was putting or planning to put towards a two-month sales tax holiday. To me, the unemployment insurance trust fund that really got hit completely hard during the pandemic, that should be one area where I would think he should focus on, because that helps the small businesses that employ all the people in the state, getting them back onto the work roles. And at the same time, the enhanced unemployment, I think most states who have taken away the enhanced unemployment have been able to get a majority of people back to the workforce that were there before. And I think that, you know, small businesses right now are having a tough time in our state trying to get employees, you know, back. So it would be another step.
Are you advocating? Yeah. So are you advocating for early ending of enhanced unemployment?
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, I think right now is the time to do that. We've got more jobs than I think people that are looking for work at this point. So it's certainly certainly the time, I think, to move people from the roles back into the workforce. I think it's going to make for, obviously, less demand on the unemployment fund. It's going to also, obviously, give people, I think, a better sense of satisfaction going back to work. And obviously, we can collect tax revenue off of the work that they're doing. So there's multiple benefits to getting everybody back to work.
Okay, we've talked about the national party. Let's talk about the state Republican Party now. Whoever wins the Republican nomination, essentially, I think one argues they become the head of the party. Do you agree? And is that what you want to be? Do you want to be the head of the state Republican Party?
I'm looking to be the executive officer for the state of Massachusetts. It just so happens that I guess you influence the way your party acts. But I've got a friend from the legislature, Jim Lyons, who served with me for 8 years, who's currently head of the Mass GOP. I'll leave it to him to handle the headaches and all the work that needs to be done as far as party building.
Yeah, you know, you're going to get asked this. Do you support Lyons? He's quite controversial right now. A number of people, most elected Republicans in the state, have called on him to resign. Do you support him as the state party chair?
Well, I do support Jim, and I'll tell you, there's an internal fight within the Mass GOP, just like I think you'd admit there's internal struggles within the Democratic Party. I mean, there's factions that seem to be very progressive versus moderate Democrats, and I think the same thing's happening in the Mass GOP, only our issues tend to spill out into the press a bit more. So, I think it's truthfully a mirror of what's happening nationally. You see the struggle within the National Democratic Party, the National Republican Party, as to who's the leader and really what are the issues they want to move forward with. But no, Jim and I certainly served together from 2010 to 2018. We know each other and basically at this point, I think Jim is trying to make sure that the Mass GOP is focused on supporting all candidates from lower level races, municipal races, all the way up through the legislature, whereas the focus in the past has always been just on the top of the ticket, really, the presidential candidate, then the governor's candidate every other 2 years. So I think, I see what Jim's trying to do, and I think there's some resistance to it, but I think he'll get past that.
So lightning round here, Jeff Diehl. Make the case for why a Republican is the right choice in the corner office for the Commonwealth.
Well, first of all, this state has a history of electing Republican governors as the counterbalance to the Democratic supermajorities in the House and Senate. But on top of that, yes, I may be center-right. Governor Baker may legislate center-left somewhat. But I think that the Democrat nominee, if national politics dictate where their policy or where their thinking is going to be, may be too radical for the state. So that's one thought going into this. But on top of that, again, I think my experience and work for the people of Massachusetts in the past is also going to be an asset.
Okay, former state representative from Whitman, Jeff Diehl. He is running for the Republican nomination for governor here in Massachusetts. Jeff Diehl, we hope you will come back and speak with us again as the campaign kind of cranks up.
Sounds good, TCN. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. Listeners, this is the first in a series of conversations that we plan to bring you this summer with all the major candidates running for governor. All right, so listening into that conversation with Jeff Diehl is Anthony Brooks, WBUR's senior political reporter. Anthony, hi there.
Hey, Tiziana, nice to be with you.
So let me just start by asking you what stood out to you from Jeff Diehl there and the case he made to be governor.
Well, Diehl's proposing to take on one of the more popular governors in the country, so it's a tall order, especially because Diehl himself is running from the Trump wing of the Republican Party in a state that voted 2-1 against Trump. Now, as I listen to his interview with you, he sounds like he's recasting himself a bit as a more of a moderate Republican. But if you're trying to run in the moderate Republican lane, I think Charlie Baker pretty much owns that lane. So that's a tall order for Jeff Diehl. And if he wants to focus on local issues and move away from his former alignment with Trump, he's going to have to make that case to voters. But moving big swaths of independents away from Baker and toward him is going to be his challenge. But it's going to be fascinating to watch.
Are there any poll numbers or other data, Anthony, that suggest that Baker could be vulnerable from the right with Jeff Diehl's candidacy?
Well, not, I mean, what we know is that Baker is more popular among Democrats than with Republicans. And, you know, his sort of secret sauce, as I've said on this show before, is that he's won over a lot of Democrats and a lot of independents and enough Republicans to be a very popular governor. Now, in terms of making a case, I mean, we heard Deal making a case. I mean, Baker's has made some missteps along the way. I mean, he's got to contend with a state police overtime fraud scandal. He, you know, there's a case to be made that the Holyoke Soldiers Home tragedy, where 76 veterans died, happened on his watch with someone that he helped appoint. You know, even the T, which Baker made a priority, has had problems, and there were also problems with the rollout of the vaccine. But none of that seems to stick. That's the issue that Baker seems to benefit from. So the latest poll we have back in March from Suffolk University and the Boston Globe shows 7 in 10 Massachusetts voters still approve of Baker. They give him high marks, especially for his management of the pandemic. So he'll be tough to beat.
All right. So I want to talk a little bit about sequencing here. So in the offing, we have question marks over the heads of Attorney General Maura Healey, and as I talked about with Jeff Deal, Governor Baker himself, and whether they're going to enter the race. It is notable that Jeff Deal entered as a Republican candidate before Governor Baker, the Republican governor, made his decision. Does this change the calculus or anything else about who might enter or when with Deal making this choice now?
I don't. You mean, are you asking, will it affect Maura Healey's decision that Deal is getting in now?
Will it affect her decision at all, or her timing, or Governor Baker's timing? I guess I'm assuming, Anthony, that there's some sort of set of dominoes here.
Yeah, I mean, I think Charlie Baker is moving toward a decision. And I think, you know, inevitably he's taking his time, and that's because he's the incumbent and he can afford to. The fact that he now has a challenger from the right, sure, I'm sure that is a bit of a nudge that he's going to have to make up his mind. But, you know, he's been pretty consistent with his statements about when he's going to make up his mind. And it's coming eventually, but he keeps sort of trotting out the same answer, that that's a decision that he and Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito have to make in conversations with their families, and that decision's coming soon. But I don't get the sense that Deal jumping into the race is necessarily lighting a fire under that decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. All right. So last 30 seconds. What else? Obviously, you'll be watching for those potential announcements. What else are you going to watch for over the summer as the race heats up?
Well, we shouldn't forget that there are three really interesting Democrats running for governor as well. Former State Senator Ben Downing, State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz, and Harvard Professor Danielle Allen. Clearly, it's going to be a steep climb for them, but I'll be interested to see how they make their cases that voters should expect more from a governor. I mean, Baker has cast himself as an able administrator, and polls suggest that that's enough for Massachusetts voters who seem to like him. So the challenge for these Democrats is that a governor can and should do a lot more and address these systemic inequalities that plague parts of our economy. So I'll be looking for that case, how they make that case and how voters respond.
And we will invite all three of them to make their cases here on Radio Boston. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks.
My pleasure.
Massachusetts' Haitian community is the third largest in the United States, about 86,000 people, and they are hurting this week. Political upheaval after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse Wednesday, and that after months of violence and protests, even as the country continues trying to rebuild from a devastating 2010 earthquake and a hurricane in 2016. The politics are complicated, involving foreign aid, U.S. involvement, what appears to be a constitutional crisis. They are important, and there is so much more to unpack there. But what we want to focus on today here is our neighbors and their families back home. And we invite you to join the conversation. Do you have family or friends in Haiti about whom you're worried? Neighbors, coworkers, loved ones here that you know who are affected. Or maybe you have questions for how to help and support your community in this time. Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined by two community leaders. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the CEO of a cannabis company. She was the first Haitian Asian American elected to state office in the U.S. and is a friend of the show. Also, Linda Dorsina-Forey, former Massachusetts state senator, the first Haitian American woman elected to the state Senate and now a vice president at Suffolk Construction. Marie and Linda, thanks to both of you for coming today.
Good to be with you today.
So I'm going to ask you each sort of in turn, just because we can't see each other, how you are. Marie, how are you?
I'm good. Worried about the many people who today are feeling very insecure, their level of insecurity and the trauma that they've been experiencing for years has been compounded. But we're lucky to be here.
Linda, how about you?
Thank you, Sienna, for having us. Same thing. I mean, I would say that, you know, it's really lifting up the people of Haiti and really thinking about their security and their safety. But it's very troubling times, more so, you know, with this horrible and horrendous act that has taken place. And so now it's about, you know, giving support, encouragement to the people on the ground.
There's so many things I want to ask the two of you just from the things you just said. I think I'll just start. Linda, I'll stay with you. And I want to ask you what your reaction was when you first heard the news of the assassination. And now, after having a couple of days to process it, so where is your head about the moment that we're in?
Thank you. I mean, I would say, you know, hearing the news, it was a devastating, you know, blow, right, to the Haiti, but to the Haitian people. And no doubt condolences and prayers go out to the Moise family. And, you know, violence, the way I look at this, you know, violence is never the answer, right? And it only makes issues, you know, facing Haiti worse. And, but it's been, you know, but there's been so much happening, right, leading up to this moment. A lot of violence, you know, in the streets, journalists, activists have been murdered, you know, also in Haiti. And so, but, you know, justice has to be brought to bear, right? And so when I see all of this taking place, we must have accountability. And, you know, those that have organized and committed these heinous acts, you know, folks have to be held accountable. But I do believe, hopefully, you know, as the leadership and the government comes to play in Haiti, that they ask for support, right? Obviously, it's a sovereign nation, Haiti. And so we respect that. And so, you know, there's just a lot of conversation to be had.
Marie, the word that really stuck out to me in your first answer was this idea of insecurity and sort of the depth of insecurity. And one thing that can be hard is just being able to talk to the people we love at home during a time of crisis. How are communications with people in the country? Have you been able to get information from your friends and loved ones there? What are you hearing about the ability to reach family and community members on the ground in Haiti?
So I think the assassination of the sitting president, it is a step beyond much of the violence that we've seen in this country for decades. And so I think it has had a chilling effect for Haitians in Haiti and Haitians of all stripes abroad. And so that level of insecurity has really, you know, it is increasing the tension. I think unlike even the horrible earthquake, where there was no systems of communicating, that technology has advanced even this short period that has allowed a platform for people to connect over social media. And through cell phones and what have you, I think people are able to connect more directly than they've had in the past. They have access, again, through social media to be able to get news. And of course, as you're able to get good news, as we do in this country, you're also getting information that is incorrect. And so that creates another level of concern. So I think we're able to stay connected. The concern, though, is but everything is stopped, right? In this country. And this is a country that has been trying to recover from the earthquake, as you said at the top of the segment. It's also been trying to recover from the cholera epidemic, which still is impacting them. And they're still trying to figure out how to deal with COVID, which has just began to really take off in this country. And so if you think about it, if everything is stopped, then how is support being delivered through the health system? How are the remittances that many people rely on that come from Haitian communities across the world? That is how many families are able to sustain themselves. How is that getting in? How are they able to sustain themselves? And what kind of, you know, and I think about the community here for people who still have lots of family, how are they coping? They're worried about their families here on the ground here in Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, Hyde Park, Brockton, across the state. I mean, and now they're also worrying about how their families are faring on the ground in Haiti. So there's a lot of insecurity in communities across Massachusetts right now.
We're talking with Marie St. Fleur and Linda Dorsina Forey, both former elected officials here in the Commonwealth, about the events in Haiti over the last couple of days and how to support both our local Haitian community and the Haitian community in country. Linda, how are people coping here over the last couple of days?
I would say, you know, as we talk to the Haitian community and the folks, is that, you know, people are trying to get in touch. Obviously, they're getting in touch with their families. Marie Mensch said it best, right, in terms of the media piece. WhatsApp is one of the ways that people are connecting and really checking in. And I think for us, too, it's saying how is it that we can ask for calm, right? Calm in Haiti, yes, but also calm in the diaspora, right? And really, as Haitians who are here and abroad, is how do we help, you know, bring some sense of security and really asking for people to try to de-escalate everything, because this is really, really a tense time. And I think the piece around, you know, some fake news is happening all over the place, right? And so we do not have all the facts yet. And I think it's going to be important that people wait for that, that the investigation takes place to really let, so we can understand, you know, who assassinated the president and what happened. But I do think there is a lot of concern. As I went to the Haitian restaurants yesterday, and folks are like, they can't even talk about it, right? Because it's just pure shock, one. And it's also, there are folks on either both sides, right? And again, no matter political affiliations, you know, that aside, this should never be an option, right? And so there's that piece too, where people are just in shock and are really just dealing with it kind of themselves internally and not necessarily expressing.
I do want to put out to listeners one more time, how are you coping with the news, especially if you or someone you love is directly affected? 1-800-423-8255. Linda, you talked about shock. Marie, you've used the word insecurity. Marie, you used trauma at the beginning. I want to get a sense for people here, without doing it in any kind of a voyeuristic way, the level of basic needs vulnerability for the population, especially in Port-au-Prince, but around Haiti right now. How do we think about that, Marie? How do we understand the magnitude of the basic needs kinds of vulnerabilities?
Well, I think that folks who've been following what's been happening in Haiti understood that for at least the past 3 to 4 years, honestly, the issue of hunger has increased in the country. It is a country that was consistently trying to deal with power outages. And so therefore, most businesses as well as homes had difficulty just trying to live their daily lives. It was a country, honestly, that in the past 6 months particularly, that there were growing concerns. Even members of Congress were talking about the proliferation of gangs and the proliferation of guns that have actually paralyzed huge segments of the capital city. And so those are the tensions where from day to day going out, people did not feel safe going out to get basic necessities, whether it's groceries, going to pharmacy, that people felt really uncomfortable. There were increases in kidnapping. And I believe that members of the Haiti caucus and at the congressional level had raised these issues and really tried to bring to the fore the continuing growing insecurity in Haiti. You know, there was a lot going on here, and the international community had not paid attention to what was going on. When I think of, and so that is where people are, where you are fearful of stepping out of your house. I believe that is where a lot of the community, particularly in the capital city, Port-au-Prince, that is where a lot of people are. I want to say that as I think about the community here in Boston, people, Haitians are not going to tell you, they don't wear it on their sleeves. They're just going to keep pushing forward. And so particularly those of them who are working in hospitality, I ask the employers to check in because they're not, the Haitian community is not going to say, oh, woe is me, so I'm not going to show up for it. They're going to show up. It's how they show up. So I ask people to be considerate of that. I ask people for them, particularly they work in the healthcare industry, right? They're the ones taking care of your loved ones. They're the ones who are cleaning. And a lot of that staff that are in your hospitals and your nursing homes and other healthcare facilities, they're going to show up. It's how they show up. And to have some thought, I think that is how we could be supportive, to be cognizant that these folks are dealing with some real trauma right now, as they are concerned about what is going on at home. And as it relates to the community organizations that are there to support those families, perhaps philanthropy can begin to think about what type of mental health support or what other types of support that they could deploy at those community-based organizations to help sustain. Children are home right now, because I remember as a child, I was a child when my parents were dealing with Duvalier and learning that day to day, we were learning that somebody was either killed or what have you. And we didn't understand what was going on at home. And for a child, they're not going to talk to you about it, but you know something is wrong. We are more advanced now. 50 years ago, it would have been a problem. We are more advanced. So we need to be thinking about what kind of support we can help, particularly if the children are in your daycare centers, if they're in your after school programs. How do you lift them up as in order to provide them a stable, secure place so that they have some coverage before they return home? So if we're thinking about specific things we can do, think about your neighbor. What are ways we could be supportive?
We have a call to that end, so I'm just going to grab it real quick, and then I'm going to turn to you, Linda. Donna's in Brockton. Briefly, Donna, go ahead.
Yes, this story has opened my eyes because although I have friends, and I'm actually going to on my way to pick up my kids' daycare, and the daycare owner, she's a Haitian, and she's a Haitian immigrant. She wasn't born here, and she has foster children as well. She just does a lot for us in this country. I always just thought, okay, this is just a cholera. This is just an earthquake. Like, they're resilient people, and throughout history they have been. And I never thought to, like, honestly care, and I do care. So listening from this story, I'm definitely going to reach out more. But also, as far as, like, I'm also thinking about on the political side, is the president, you know, if things get bad, are Haitians going to come here? Are we going to extend them benefits, you know, for them to come here to get support as well?
Let's take that back from you, Donna, because that is a question I wanted to ask about. And Linda, I remember being one of many people who worked with you and Marie after 2010 on a number of responses, including helping people get temporary protected status. Do you anticipate we'll see more people leaving the country and coming to the area? And how do we be helpful and prepare for that?
Very good. Thank you. First, I want to thank you, Donna, for calling in and for really asking, you know, your childcare provider, you know, how is she feeling and how is she coping? And Marie, thank you for lifting that up, because I do think, you know, we can take that moment and the time, you know, as employers and as just people, human beings, to just say, you know, is everything okay? Is your family okay? We're thinking of you and praying for you. I would say that in terms of the TPS under the Biden administration, they've extended it, right? Which is a great thing. And obviously the Haitians are part of the temporary protective status. So that's really exciting that's happening. Again, we may see, right? We know that every time, you know, there are conflicts, not just in Haiti, but any country, you know, that is when a migration tends to happen. So hopefully, you know, we have organizations here in terms of the nonprofits that's done a lot, in particular the Haitian community, that are able, if there are new people that come, to be able to give support and to give services. But again, we hope that the situation in Haiti becomes stabilized, right? And that, you know, that the government and that, you know, they ask, as a sovereign nation, they ask for support and help from the U.S. And I'm sure our government is willing and able to do that. President Biden has said that already. And a lot of our congressional delegations have stepped up as well.
All right. That is Linda Dorsina-Forey, former Massachusetts state senator, the first Haitian American woman elected to the state Senate, now at Suffolk Construction, and Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the CEO of a cannabis company. We're with you both. Our hearts are with you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tatiana.
Thank you.
A Brockton student is a newly minted gold medalist in oratory. She's Julie Canuto de Pina, and she won it in a competition held by the NAACP. Her speech is titled 846. Here's an excerpt.
It took the murder of George Floyd in a pandemic to give us 2020 vision, forcing us to stay home, pay attention, fight for our rights, resist in protest against police brutality, and to use our voice. Minneapolis Police Department, guilty. Derek Chauvin, guilty. Our justice system, guilty. America, guilty.
Canuto de Pina joined students across the country to participate in the NAACP's year-long ACT SO achievement program. ACT SO stands for Afro-Academic, Cultural, Technological, and Scientific Olympics. The program pairs students with a mentor as they participate in one of 30 categories of academic competitions in the sciences, humanities, business, and the performing and visual arts. Canuto de Pina won a local gold medal in the oratory category and is competing in the National ACT SO competition later this week, representing the Brockton branch of the NAACP. We caught up with Julie Canuto de Pina earlier this week as she prepared for the national competition. And to start, I asked her to tell us about herself. Who is Julie Canuto de Pina?
So right now, I just graduated from high school, from Southeastern Regional Vocational Technical High School, located in Southeastern Mass. And I'm going into college this year. I will be going into nursing at Boston College. And I'm a very outgoing person. I enjoy working with people. I enjoy meeting new people, trying new things. I'm a very athletic person and very engaging and optimistic.
Julie, you referred to yourself as an athlete, somebody who's very into sports. How did you wind up in a speech competition?
That's a great question. So last year, like towards the end of the year, our school like sent out an email about Axel and the NAACP. And although I had like a lot of sports things going on and extracurricular activities, I was very intrigued by what Axel was, that I wanted to see what it was all about. And I saw that there was an oratory competition, and I actually had done a few public speaking events at my school. But I saw ACT SO as an opportunity to take my public speaking levels to another level and speak about things that I'm very passionate about.
You know, you could have written about anything, really, anything. And you chose to focus on police brutality and the death of George Floyd. What made you decide to focus there? And how did that feel in your heart to decide to write about that?
The time that this ACT SO competition got brought up to me, a lot of Black Lives Matter movement was going on and like all over the media. And just in general, I was very disturbed by what Derek Chauvin did in the murder of George Floyd. And it really woke me up as a youth and advocate to no longer just stand back and read the news or watch the news, but instead like use my voice to advocate and wake like other youth up. And so I decided that why do I have to keep just reading news and telling people about what happened when I can use my voice, put everything that I'm feeling and what I see into a speech and move other people to kind of act and do the same.
Was it hard to put what you were feeling and seeing into this speech? I have to imagine it was painful. I wonder, did you have support? Was it challenging? Did it write itself?
It was very challenging writing this speech because I also wanted to make sure that what I was saying stuck with everyone and came from all different sides. And I had a lot of help from Pat Monteith and Michael Curry, who helped me organize my ideas into how I wanted this speech to be structured.
Pat Monteith and Michael Curry were mentors through the NAACP, right?
Yes. And I really wanted the words to resonate with an audience when I said my speech, but I also wanted the words to be what I was feeling and how I felt this case has brought an awakening to people to come to action and call to action and see what's actually happening in the world.
You know, you talk about making sure that what you said really stuck. In watching your speech, one of the things that really stuck with me were these mundane activities that you pointed out can happen in 8 minutes. And there was something about putting eating breakfast next to this murder that really disturbed, I think, in a way I'm assuming you wanted it to. I wondered, was it hard to deliver, to talk about and orate something so disturbing? And I'm assuming you must have done it repeatedly, both in practicing it and then taping it for this competition.
Yes, it was very disturbing to think that you can do these daily things that happened in like 8 minutes and or even more. And it's like so much time that like you can bathe in it. We don't realize that that time, those minutes and those seconds, actually in our lives, we're able to do these things every day. But for George Floyd on that day, that was all the time he had.
Do you have a sense of what justice looks like to you? And are you hopeful that we are headed in that direction as a country?
I feel like our criminal justice system is in need of serious transformation. I definitely still remain hopeful that it's on the path towards that, and it's progress, and progress is key. It's helping us move to a better path.
And Julie, last question for you. What's your dream for yourself and your future?
Definitely, I see myself working in the medical field as a pediatric nurse practitioner, but at the same time, more so thinking about it in the moment, I definitely see myself being an activist and advocate in areas of social justice and using my voice and public speaking skills to bring about awareness and speak about inequality in our system and open and use my voice to open up other youth to do the same and use their voice whenever they feel like something isn't right or something in our system needs change. I want to inspire others.
That's Julie Canuto DePina. She recently won a local gold medal in the NAACP Afro-Academic, Cultural, Technological, and Scientific Olympics. She'll represent the Brockton chapter of the NAACP in the national competition later this week. Here at Radio Boston, listeners, we care passionately about what you want to hear. So here's your chance to tell us exactly what that is. We have posted a survey online, and we'd really love for you to weigh in. Tell us what you think, and be honest. What do you want more of? Maybe less. Tell us. Go to wbur.org/survey. That's wbur.org/survey. And thanks in advance for doing it. We look forward to hearing from you. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.